Critchley, arise to make some introductions, pertaining for Mira Pride Services, the petitioner Polo and Ali here. First, I have my co-counsel from California, Philip Unsucker, who has been admitted pro DJ.
Our practice is to stand when you're introduced. Welcome to the court.
I also have from our firm, Jill Agro, who some of your honors may know. And then also the general counsel of my client, Regine Rock.
Welcome.
And I would be remiss if I also did not note that my wife and daughter are also here today. My daughter just finished school and is here for a summer civics lesson to see what daddy does and to see my name on the plaque.
It's always reassuring to see the name still there, isn't it, Mr. Hammond?
Thank you, Your Honor.
We did as well.
Your Honors, the matter before the court today discusses or involves the interrelatedness between sections 278 and 279 of the Delaware Corporation Law. As the court is aware, section 278 permits corporations to remain in existence for a wind down period of 3 years unless ordered longer by the court. To wind up as a bearer. The legislative intent of Section 278 is to balance the public policy interest of ensuring the claimants have adequate time to bring claims against the corporation and the public policy interest of allowing directors, officers, and stockholders to be free from claims relating to the dissolved corporation after sufficient time has passed. In other words, Section 278 serves as a type of statute of limitations. And my understanding is not strictly a statute of limitations, but a close cousin. But it does act as a bright line time bar for claims. Recognizing that it is too late under Section 278 to bring a claim against Texas Eastern Overseas, Ameripride, in our opinion, seeks to end run that prohibition by using the guise of a receiver to bring a claim that would otherwise be time barred. We believe that is an improper purpose for the use of Section 279 and should not be permitted. Section 279 permits the appointment of a receiver after expiration of the 278 wind-down period. However, that appointment is not automatic and is subject to certain restrictions. First, a party such as Ameripride can only seek appointment of a receiver for good cause shown. It's our position in this case that Ameripride has not shown good cause and I'm not spending that more in my argument. Second, a receiver may only be appointed for reasons specifically enumerated in Section 279. Which are to take charge of the corporation's property, to collect the debts and property due and belonging to the corporation, and as necessary for those asset marshaling purposes, to bring and defend suits in the name of the dissolved corporation. As I said, Ameripride does not have a good cause to bring a claim under 279 because it is not for one of those enumerated purposes. Ameripride makes no effort to disguise its intention for this receiver under 279. I made very clear in the argument before the court below and in its papers that it may bring this receiver in as a nominal figure only, not to do anything, just to be named and then go away, so that Ameripride, not the receiver, so that Ameripride may bring litigation against the dissolved corporation, contrary to the 3-year time limit in Section 278.
Well, wouldn't the receiver have some responsibility under the circumstances to determine if there is insurance and if there's the demand of defense and to demand coverage?
The receiver would have certain fiduciary obligations to the corporation, Your Honor, to act as a fiduciary of the corporation, to marshal the corporation's assets, and to serve as a steward of the defense of the corporation, but that's not the relief that's being sought. Ameripride has made very clear that it has no intention for the receiver to do that.
Well, whether Ameripride intends that or not, doesn't the receiver have a duty to do that?
It would be
So waiting in the wings is the coverage litigation as to whether or not there's a duty to defend, as to whether or not there's proper notice was given, and all the various insurance, environmental insurance coverage issues that can arise?
That is correct, Ron. I can't predict the future, but it strikes me that there are quite a volume of claims and defenses that will be raised with respect to litigation coverage that the receiver would have to respond to and anticipate.
Excuse me, why are you saying that officers and directors would be having to participate in the litigation?
Your Honor, it is our position that those would be the folks, so to speak, with the boots on the ground, who would have participated in the negotiation or procurement.
Oh, so you're saying that they might be witnesses?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
We believe that would be necessary for factual background information and to facilitate the proper defense of the following litigation.
Well, let's assume that the Vice Chancellor can read the statutes just like you read the statute to us, and understands cause and the elements of cause in order to have a receiver appointed under 279. Where did the Vice Chancellor get the analysis incorrectly?
Your Honor, we believe that there were several points where, with all the respect, the analysis was incorrect. One is, and we believe this is an overview by this Court, of the interpretation of the interrelatedness between these two statutes public policy concerns. We believe that Section 278 provides a bright line time period by which claims must be brought against the corporation or the loss. And in this case, there's no...
Well, what does the phrase mean after the 3 years? There's a comma and then there's a phrase. What does that phrase mean?
It is our position that that phrase means that after those 3 years, that no further new claims can be brought or suits can be brought against the dissolved corporation. And that, Your Honor, is now something that happened in the 14th state with respect to statute of limitations over time. There are certain time limits by which court claims must bring claims where there are laws. And to say, well, there is insurance proceeds possibly for those court claims is not save those claims once the statute of limitations is expired. It's not enough for plaintiff. Waited too long and the statute has expired to come back later and say, well, I know I missed the deadline. However, there may be insurance coverage, so no harm, no foul, and I'm going to bring the claim anyway. That is not the way the civil justice system works with respect to statute of limitation. And we believe that is precisely what Ameriprise is seeking to do here with respect to 278. Another point of error, to respond to Your Honor's question, is with respect to whether an asset was demonstrated. Ameriprise makes much argument about what we put forward a piece of paper. It's more than in Ray Dow Chemical cases. They did not a piece of paper. We brought forward a piece of paper. But we don't believe that carries the day, because on closer examination, those documents don't show insurance coverage exists for Texas Eastern Overseas. Those papers on the face, and as I believe Ameriprise even acknowledges, says that insurance coverage is issued with respect to Petrolin, a completely different corporation, perhaps some of its subsidiaries or those under its financial control, of which Texas and Overseas was neither. So to suggest that those documents somehow evidence insurance coverage for Texas Eastern Overseas is at best a generous read of those documents.
Was Texas Eastern Overseas a named insured in the policy?
No, not any of the documents that we've been shown anyway, and none that are before the court. And if it were, I believe, obviously we'd have a different situation, but as far as I know, Texas Eastern Overseas was not a named insured.
But there's a determination by a board that there's insurance, and was... How was the process leading up to that determination? What was that?
Your Honor, I'll confess I'm not 100% familiar with how the California Water Control Board operates. insurance coverage for VIS, again, a different corporate entity that CEO subsequently bought. And that has been extrapolated out through Amerified's arguments and below for the court below in its decision to somehow suggest that that leads to the conclusion that there is possibly insurance coverage for TPO, Texas Eastern Overseas.
I'm having a little problem with this conceptually. If it were undisputed that there was insurance coverage, then you would agree that there's an asset, right?
No, Your Honor. We don't agree that insurance coverage is an asset that can be transferred or otherwise secured by someone other than the insured.
Well, this would be a trustee acting on behalf of the insured, right? I mean, or successor to the insured. Let's just assume that the whole issue of whether TEO has any coverage under any existing policy has been resolved in TEO's favor. Would you agree at that point that TEO has an asset for which a trustee could pursue some recovery?
No, we don't, Your Honor. Again, we don't believe that insurance coverage is an asset in that sense of the word for purposes of this statutory scheme. It is a risk allocation mechanism for Texas Eastern Overseas, but is not an asset for Ameriprise, a third party unrelated to that insurance contract, to somehow levy against or garner an interest.
Well, I thought Justice Berger asked you to assume that TEO wasn't insured. If you would make that assumption, is a right to be indemnified under a contract an asset?
It would be an asset of TEO, Texas Eastern Overseas, if I may use the acronym TEO.
Yeah.
TEO would be an asset of TEO, but not an asset of Ameriprise to seek recovery of via a. Ameriprise has no ownership interest in the asset, to put it another way. So it would have no right under Section 279 to have a receiver secure or marshal that asset for distribution to TEO.
But assume that it did. The question is the right to be indemnified by contract by an insurance carrier an asset?
We believe it will be an asset of TEO.
Okay.
All right. I apologize about missing Your Honor's question, but it will be an asset of TEO, but not.
No, I get that point. I think what Justice Berger and I wanted to know, and she'll correct me if I misstated her question, was whether or not the right to be indemnified, the right to be defended in a lawsuit, is an asset if you're an insured.
I believe it would be.
Okay.
And again, I want to make clear, we don't believe that for purposes of the statute, the type of asset that the statute is referring to for Ameriprise, it's an asset of the insured, the contractually bound party, not some third party to that contract.
Why did the Vice Chancellor resolve that otherwise?
I believe he my understanding is he made an assumption, and based on that assumption, went forward with the analysis that there was indeed an asset identified.
And his assumption was that it was an Ameripride asset?
That is our...
Based on what finding of fact?
I don't know, Your Honor. I assume based on the rough interpretation of the California documents which were referenced in his opinion, again, we believe is speculative, in fact, it's speculation upon speculation. But the California Board assumed that there would be insurance proceeds for Texas Eastern Overseas based on some documents for another corporation that are wholly unrelated to the TEO. And no relationship has been shown, to put it that way.
So what is the quantum of proof that you contend is required? I mean, why shouldn't the receiver sort all this out if there's smoke, let the receiver determine if there's fire.
Your Honor, that I understand that, and that's a valid point. We consider that, Your Honor, and the problem is that eviscerates the standard under 279, because then in every case, petitioner could say, well, I know there's a lot of question about whether there's an asset or not, and whether I have a right to this, but appoint the receiver and let the receiver sort it out. That, in our opinion, is an overly simplistic answer that eviscerates the requirements under 279. Obviously, we believe the legislature had some create some threshold.
Where is the threshold then?
It's the threshold, we believe, is somewhere above speculative. This is no different than In Re Dow Chemical. What we're seeing is Ameriprise claiming definite possibility of insurance coverage, not that there is insurance coverage. They're saying these documents don't necessarily say TEO is covered, but we think that we can embroil them in enough litigation to prove it later, possibly, maybe. And it's those qualifying possibly maybes that make it speculative. And because it's speculative, we believe they fail to have established a standard for a preliminary procedure.
Did you want to save the balance of your time for rebuttal?
If I may, I'm not sure I'm excited about it.
Any other questions? Okay.
Good afternoon again, Your Honors. Because there are multiple pieces of litigation pending both here and in California, and as Your Honor noted, there will likely be upcoming coverage litigation if we proceed, I think it's necessary to be specific about what is at issue here on this appeal today, and perhaps more importantly, what's not at issue today. First, the question of whether TEO, the respondent, will ultimately found to be liable to Ameripride for the PCE contamination is not at issue here. That issue is squarely before the California Federal Court. Second, the question of whether the liability policies will ultimately provide coverage to TEO for the PCE contamination caused by BIS is also not an issue here. That will be for some other court to decide at some future date if Ameripride prevails here today and then prevails in the federal action against TEO. And third, in response to some of the questions Your Honors were asking today, the issue of whether an insurance policy is an asset is also not an issue here today. As Your Honors may recall, there was an effort by insurance industry representative to intervene as amicus in this matter. In denying that application, this court, I can remind you, ruled the issue movements wish to argue whether an insurance contract is an undistributed asset is not an issue addressed by the parties in their briefing. Accordingly, the movement's proposed brief exceeds the scope of the issues that are properly before the court in this appeal. So what is at issue today? The sole issue is whether the Court of Chancery correctly determined that Ameripride established good cause for the appointment of a receiver for TEO under Section 279. Now, admittedly, this issue does relate to some of the ultimate issues that are not before this court, in the sense of the quantum of proof that Your Honor has raised. For example, while the question of whether TEO will ultimately become liable to Ameripride is not at issue here, courts of this state have held that a claimant must have a bona fide claim in order to meet the good cause requirement under Section 279. Now, TEO did not dispute in the court below the bona fides of Ameripride's claim pending in California, and nor has it done so on this appeal. And similarly, the question of whether the liability policies will ultimately cover TEO is not an issue here, but the court below found that Ameripride needed to show a reasonable probability of coverage in order to meet the good cause requirement under 279, and that was the standard applied. Stated differently, the Court of Chancery found that Ameripride needed to provide sufficient grounds for the court to conclude that it is reasonably likely that TEO continued to hold undistributed assets, the assets here being the insurance policies. And the Court of Chancery found that Ameripride met this burden, and it's this finding that forms one of the primary disputes today. In terms of the evidence of assets or coverage, perhaps the best evidence that TEO continues to hold insurance policy assets comes from TEO's own admissions in this appeal. Its disclosure of corporate affiliations form, ordinarily a ministerial form that we filed in this court, identifies numerous insurers who have substantial financial interest in the outcome. Moreover, on the very first page of its opening brief, TEO admits that it is represented by the purported insurers of TEO. Now, the Court of Chancery didn't have the benefit of these particular admissions before it, but it did have, as Your Honors noted, the cleanup and abatement orders of the California Regional Water Quality Control Board, that's a mouthful, which noted that TEO's predecessor in interest, BIS, had insurance policies that may provide coverage for the harm caused by the contamination.
Now, does the record show the basis for that conclusion?
No, I mean, these are orders, and again, I'm also not an expert on California administrative law, but these are hearings that are held in connection with California's environmental regulatory scheme. And the finding was, apparently they had not been found yet, but the finding was that there were policies, and if they're found, maybe they're located. Well, we found them, and that's one of the things that the court also had in front.
And who were the parties to that administrative procedure?
My understanding is that a notice goes out to, potentially interested parties. I'm not sure the TEO was personally represented there, but I believe VIS, its predecessor, was given the requisite notice that would need to be given in that kind of procedure. So the court also had before it the liability policy, at which we acknowledge was issued to Petrolane. And it covered Petrolane and its subsidiaries, including specifically VIS, which is mentioned at least half a dozen times in the document. And what we're hearing today is, well, that's not, it doesn't say TEO. Well, what we have established, and the Court of Chancery found, we established that TEO was the successor by merger to VIS. And what the court also noted is that the California Federal Court stated it's an opinion that the parties agreed that because VIS was merged into corporations, which eventually merged into TEO, VIS has no separate existence from TEO. That's a finding of the California Federal Court in the plenary action going on. So based on these uncontested items, the Court of Chancery concluded that there's good reason to believe that TEO may be responsible for VIS's pollution. And if this is the case, it is also reasonable to expect that VIS's insurance policies would provide coverage for TEO's liability. And accordingly, the court held that Ameriprise had established good cause for the appointment of the receiver under Section 279. Now, notwithstanding the substantial support for the Court of Chancery's conclusion, TEO, which is admittedly represented by its insurers, effectively asks this court to pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. Conclude that Ameriprise has not demonstrated a reasonable likelihood that TEO has undistributed insurance assets. It relies on the Dow decisions, as we heard today, and it argues that our position that TEO has undistributed assets is mere speculation. But as we argued below and as the Court of Chancery found, TEO's reliance on the Dow decisions is misplaced. In Dow, the petitioner sought appointment of a receiver based on the bold assertion that there may be undistributed insurance policies, without having any evidence that such policies actually existed. Indeed, in the record in Dow, there was an unrebutted affidavit that the dissolved corporation had no assets whatsoever. Here, there's no question that policies exist. We have them. We submitted them. The only question is whether they provide coverage to TEO, an issue that will not be decided until after the federal action is resolved. We think, rather than the Dow cases, the closest case on point is this
course. Wouldn't there be a duty to defend in the federal action?
Well, I think that's Your Honor, stealing my thunder a bit, but I think that's a very good question about, how is it that TEO's insurers even purport to be here arguing on its behalf? They have to have some contractual right in order to be here and make decisions and make representations on behalf of TEO. They don't say how they're here. They say they decided to defend this. But how can, I can't just decide to defend people randomly. They must have some right to defend TEO.
Well, the typical way is under a reservation of rights. Insurance company says the policy terms call for us to defend. While we don't believe we ultimately owe you coverage, we will honor under a reservation of rights our duty, potential duty, to defend.
But that's a reservation of rights that comes from some contract. And there must be some contract that at least potentially implicates their duty to defend or duty to indemnify.
Well, they could also take the position that we don't even want to defend because we believe we not only have no duty to indemnify, but we have no duty to defend because you are not a named insured. That's an option.
They can certainly take that position. They didn't take that position. They are, the very same insurers here are defending TEO in the federal action. And in fact, they came in rather than let CEO take a default. They didn't want CEO to take a default. They decided to come in and assume the defense themselves. If they were so certain about their not being insurers of TEO, we think that they probably would have let TEO take the default. Now, our view is that, the closest case on point rather than the Dow cases is this court's decision in Addy versus Short, in which the dissolved corporation had at the time of its dissolution a possibility of reverter in certain real property. In Addy, this court observed that under the predecessor statute to Section 279, notwithstanding the expiration of the three-year period, a dissolved corporation may be made a defendant in the Court of Chancery for the appointment of a receiver, and such receiver may be appointed at any time when cause therefore appears. The court further stated that any asset of the corporation, whether vested or contingent, not disposed of during the winding-up period, may in a proper case be administered by a Court of Chancery under the statute, and the rights of creditors and stockholders protected. And with respect to the possibility of, reverter that was specifically at issue in that case, the court stated, true, it is wholly contingent, but so far as concerns the protection of its owner under the general corporation law, it is none the worse for that. It is sufficient to say that it is a right, and one which under some circumstances may be a valuable right. As such, it is brought within the reach of the statute. It constitutes, in the language of the statute, unfinished business of the corporation. So, like the possibility of reverter at issue in Addy, TEO's interests in the general liability policies of its corporate predecessor are contingent interests that existed at the time of its dissolution. They were contingent on some claim being brought that might trigger TEO's right to coverage under those policies. Now, TEO nevertheless argues that it remains speculative. We respectfully suggest that what TEO is trying to do here is say that we need to establish the right to coverage in order to be allowed to have a receiver appointed. When the court below found that that would not be, that this would not be an appropriate venue for the determination of the ultimate coverage issue, we believe the court below correctly determined that a receiver could be appointed based upon a reasonable possibility of coverage. Now, if it were actually necessary for us to prove the existence of coverage, then no receiver could ever be appointed under Section 279 to permit undistributed insurance assets to be pursued if coverage were disputed for any reason by the carriers. And as this court is aware, carriers frequently contest coverage. Now, more broadly, if TEO is right, then no receiver could ever be appointed under Section 279 where the rights sought to be protected might be contested by anyone at all. And other potential claimants or people contesting the right would prevail then by default. But the contested nature of the right is part of what makes it contingent. And Section 279 exists precisely to permit dissolved corporations to be able to protect or pursue their rights, whether those rights are vested or contingent. And if we accept the proposition that contingent rights can form the basis for the appointment of a receiver, as this court has held, then there must be some test for determining how contingent or vested those rights must be. We think the Court of Chancery's reasonable likelihood analysis is therefore the proper standard. Now, TEO also contends that the court appointed a receiver for a purpose not permitted under Section 279. Now, that statute permits a receiver to be appointed, as your honors know, to take charge of the corporation's property, to collect the debts and property due and belonging to the corporation, with the power to prosecute and defend in the name of the corporation or otherwise all such suits as may be necessary or proper for purposes aforesaid, and to do all other acts which might be done by the corporation, if it being, that may be necessary for the final settlement of the unfinished business of the corporation. We view these broad purposes as being more than sufficient to permit the Court of Chancery to appoint a receiver for the purpose of giving a dissolved corporation the capacity to be sued so that its insurance assets may be collected for the benefit of creditors, particularly given the all other acts language in the statute. Now, the parties agree that one of the policies that the court should consider here in deciding whether to appoint a receiver for a dissolved corporation is the repose that Section 278 is intended to give the corporate constituencies, that is, the former directors, officers, and stockholders, so that they can be free from having to defend against claims past the three-year period set forth in Section 278. As the Court of Chancery found, however, this case does not implicate those policies. because Ameriprise has not sued any of TEO's former directors, officers, or stockholders in the California action, and moreover, we've represented that it will not do so. The most that can possibly be said, as Your Honor asked, is that some former TEO director or officer might have to be a witness in some litigation between Ameripride and TEO or its insurers someday down the line. Now, not only is that actually what's truly speculative here, but it also does not rise, we believe, to the level of the type of repose that Section 278 seeks to protect. Having to serve as a witness may be unfortunate, and I've done it myself, but it's a far cry from the possibility of personal liability that Section 278 seeks to cut off after the 3-year period. Now, in reality, we think the TEO, here being defended by its insurers, seeks only to protect its insurers. But it cites no case law supporting the concept that Section 278 seeks to protect the interests of any constituencies outside of the corporation, be it insurers or other third parties. Indeed, Sections 278 and 279 expressly contemplate that the interests of third parties may well be affected by the appointment of a receiver.
There is obviously a potential conflict between the receiver and the insurers, correct?
There could theoretically be a conflict between the receiver and the insurers. I should note, since Your Honor was asking, we do not really contemplate that the receiver will have to take substantive actions in this matter, because the receiver is being appointed in order to give TEO the capacity to be sued in the federal action in California. We're not seeking to displace the insurer's counsel who are there, and if a judgment is entered against TEO in that action, what will happen next is Ameripride will sue the insurers directly, and TEO will essentially be out of the picture, and they're able to do that because there's a California statute that gives them the authority to pursue the insurers directly in cases like this. So
is that an assignment of the judgment or something?
It's a statute in the insurance regulatory area under California law, and I could get the citation if Your Honor wants it. I'm pretty sure it's in our briefs. But it essentially gives a direct action in a situation like this where you have a dissolved corporation that had insurance coverage, and so allows you to proceed directly and not have to deal with the inconvenience of the dissolved corporation. So right now, we're simply seeking to get the capacity to be able to sue TEO. And once we get that judgment, Ameripride will proceed directly against the insurers.
Now, within the 3 minutes you have left, can you touch on the latches argument?
Certainly, Your Honor. My colleague reminds me, it's California Insurance Code, Section 11580, Direct Action for Judgment Creditors. We think the Lashes argument fails for two reasons. First, TEO can't prove prejudice, and second, it can't prove unreasonable delay, which are the two elements of Lashes. Starting with delay, Ameripride did not unreasonably delay in seeking the appointment of a receiver because it did so within several months of the federal court ruling that it would need to do that in order to continue the federal action. TEO argues that the delay should instead be measured from the time that it, TEO, first raised the lack of capacity defense, which was in the year 2000. Yet TEO did not move to dismiss or for summary judgment based on that defense until 2008, and it only did so on the eve of having a default judgment entered against it when its insurers stepped up to the plate and decided to defend it. So the matter wasn't briefed until 2008. And we think to say that Ameripride had a duty to seek a receiver back in 2000 simply because someone raised a defense might well never have been briefed, and before the court had actually ruled on the validity of the defense, really turns the litigation process on its head. And finally, there's no proof of prejudice to TEO. Instead, the only argument we've heard really is that there's prejudice to the insurers from this. Of course, the insurers are not parties here, and they seek to have the court ignore their existence for purposes of establishing the existence of insurance assets. So we don't think it should be permitted to have it both ways on that.
Now, you've said that the coverage is not an issue in this litigation. So to the extent that delay may become an issue in a coverage litigation. Is there not raised judicata of that issue by virtue of this receivership application?
I don't think that there is any ruling on that one way or the other, Your Honor. The issue has to do with whether there was delay in seeking the appointment of a receiver. I'm sure the insurers are free to raise whatever defenses they think they're permitted to raise. I mean, obviously, CERCLA is a statutory scheme that contemplates liability over a very long period of time. Insurers contract to cover certain liabilities that arose, it can be tens or twenties of years ago. And so whether they have a delay defense is something that I'm sure they can raise if they seek to do so in coverage litigation. Anything else, Your Honor, I'd be happy to answer your questions before I go.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Attention from the fact that there is really no good cause for a receiver to be appointed here. And again, what we've heard is we're not going to rely on the receiver to do anything. We just want to, Ameriprise wants to bring a new lawsuit against a defunct corporation well after the Section 278 time period to do so has elapsed. And we're going to use this end run, 279, to accomplish that to the contrary. I believe that is improper. We don't believe Addy is on point here, certainly no more than in Ray J. Alchemical. In Addy, there was definitive evidence of the interest. Here, what we've heard is there's speculation that maybe there's an interest. They acknowledge the TEO is not a named insured, that some other corporate entities are, that they're going to perhaps, possibly, maybe, prove at some point in the future through very expensive and exhaustive litigation. That there may be insurance coverage here. And that's going to, be speculative. As Your Honor's asked, and we followed the case, there was really no findings, or at least there's no evidence before this court nor the court chancellor of how the California administrative body reached its conclusions that the court chancellor relied almost exclusively on to find that there was a valid interest here for a receiver. That is a glaring error. There's pure speculation. In fact, it's speculation upon speculation because we have no idea what the court, the California administrative body was looking at.
Well, doesn't the Petrolane policy, which covered VIS and with TEO being the successor to VES, isn't there a reasonable probability of coverage under that policy?
Well, we don't believe so, Your Honor. That's a very complex question. It's not an easy one to answer. Analysis under the law, insurance law, things of that nature, which is not before this court. And that's our point. This policy says Petrolane and its subsidiary, perhaps the name's VIS, or other entities for which Petrolane has financial control. TEO doesn't fit any of those definitions. TEO bought the entire number of shares of Petrolane and VIS. It was never under Petrolane or VIS's financial control, nor was it a subsidiary of either of those named insurers. On its face, Ameriprise, quote unquote, showing of an asset fails. And we believe that is insufficient to have a receiver appointed. And the court of chancery's reliance on some mere suggestions of a speculative assumption in a California administrative body's findings is insufficient to demonstrate something more than is necessary than to have a receiver appointed. As Chancellor Chandler pointed out in Ray Dow, has to be more than speculation. We have nothing more here. They're showing a piece of paper that shows some other named insured. That's no different than having no paper at all.
is crucial. And again, the, all quoted in our papers, what America is seeking to do is not just call the players back in the dressing room to start the game over again. After the players have gone home, the referees have gone home, the audience has gone home, the stadium's torn down, everyone's gone and forgotten about this game. And they want to call them back at this late hour to start this all over again. And that's just inappropriate.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.